Today is Thursday, February 21st, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and coming up.
It does impact our ability to go to and from the airport in Port-au-Prince, so that bringing teams in, we bring American teams in twice a month, bringing teams in has been impacted dramatically.
That's Dr. David Vanderpool, a trauma surgeon and founder of Live Beyond, a medical mission in Haiti. Also ahead, Democrats in the U.S. House of Representatives prepare to introduce a resolution opposing President Donald Trump's declaration of a national emergency on the U.S. border with Mexico. It's all on today's International Edition. While U.S.-supported forces have handed over a group of Islamic State fighters to officials in Iraq as they prepare to clear the last area in Syria still under the militants' control. The Kurdish-led Syrian Democratic Forces, or SDF, have been waiting for civilians to leave the village of Baghouz before launching a final offensive. Hundreds of civilians, including women and children, have been released from the area. Witnesses said they saw about 10 trucks leave. While the situation in Baghouz, the Syrian town where the Islamic State is making its last stand, is complex, fighters and their family members are trying to leave the area. As many as 1,000 women and children remain. But Syrian Democratic Forces battling the militants are not sure what to do with the foreign fighters and their families who have surrendered or who have been captured. Some countries are unwilling to take their citizens back. My colleague Mario Ritter Jr. spoke with VOA's Istanbul correspondent Heather Murdoch, who was in Iraq traveling to Baghouz.
What I'm hearing from people who are on the ground in Baghouz right now in that area, that people are still coming out. Last night, it was believed that about 2,000 people were left in the areas where Islamic State militants are still fighting. Today, hundreds more people escaped and were transported up to a refugee camp. It is expected that, as you said, 1,000 people might be still in there or possibly more.
What have you heard about the condition of the people? How many are fighters? How many are family members?
The people who are left in the area where the militants are still fighting are either the militants themselves or are probably their relatives, wives and children. The conditions for them, I would expect to be and have been proven to be so far very rough. They've been under siege for a long time. People come out of these kinds of fights often starving, always traumatized, and of course they will have a lot of children with them that will need immediate care if it's available.
Do you know whether the Syrian Democratic Forces are equipped to handle this influx?
Well, the conditions at the main camp, the Al-Hol camp, are reported to be wretched, and that's the main camp where people are going to right now. Over this winter, about 30 children died from hypothermia, according to WHO, and as this spring it's starting to get warmer, they're also facing a very, very hot summer. So the extreme weather and a lack of food and fuel have also been reported. They don't have the resources to take care of this many people without more help.
Have you heard anything about repatriation, where women, children, and the fighters themselves come from other countries?
It seems to be a stalemate at the moment, where the Syrian Democratic Forces say they cannot, they don't have the resources to hold about 700 fighters and thousands of women and children that are family members of these fighters that are all foreign. But most countries have said that they do not want to take these fighters back to try them in their home countries. Recently, or I think Wednesday night, there was a transfer of 150 Iraqis to Iraq from Syria, which has been the largest by far transfer of captured militants from one country to the next. But it's also believed that there may be tens of thousands more Iraqis held in Syria as militants.
Are you finding that most are actually from Iraq?
It's actually not clear who these Iraqis actually are, if they were captured recently or if they were captured any time in the past few years that they've been fighting Islamic State militants. So, no, I don't know if they came directly from Baghouz or if they have been held for a long time. The Syrian Democratic Forces have been holding foreign fighters for now. It's been going on a couple of years that they've been winning this battle and therefore taking in foreign fighters. It's come to a head recently because the forces are saying they can't afford to take care of all these people.
What do you know about the international presence there, NGOs or other organizations?
Well, there are support organizations across Syria, but they're very limited in terms of their access to certain areas because of the fighting. And they're also limited in resources. They usually just don't have enough of anything to go around. The war has been going on now for a long time, and there's certainly sympathy fatigue is what they call it among NGOs, where for so long there's been so many people suffering, it's hard to keep interest in international support for all of the different battle zones.
That is Heather Murdoch speaking with my colleague Mario Ritter Jr. earlier today on her way to Baghouz through Iraq. Well, Democrats in the U.S. House of Representatives are preparing to introduce a resolution opposing President Donald Trump's declaration of a national emergency on the U.S. border with Mexico. The full House probably will vote on the bill by the middle of March. Trump declared a national emergency last week to secure more money for additional barriers on the border to stop illegal entry into the country. Congress passed budget legislation giving the president almost $1.4 billion, but that was less than the $5.7 billion the administration was seeking. The House is expected to pass the resolution, but passage is not certain in the Republican-controlled Senate. If the resolution clears both chambers, political analysts say Trump is likely to veto it. Well, Arab media is reporting that both the Saudi-led coalition and forces loyal to the Houthi militia group are starting to implement a redeployment agreement worked out by mediators in the Swedish capital Stockholm last December. Witnesses, however, say that they have not detected significant movement of forces. Edward Uranian reports for VOA from Cairo.
Arab media reported scattered clashes in parts of Yemen Thursday, despite some reports that the warring sides had begun to implement a UN-sponsored redeployment in and around the Yemeni port city of Hodeida. Optimism about the Hodeida agreement during a presentation by UN envoy Martin Griffiths to the Security Council several days ago created fresh hope about jump-starting the stalled plan for the country's largest port and lifeline to the capital, Sana'a.
Since I last talked to you a few weeks ago, we have made some significant progress in the implementation of the agreements reached in Stockholm towards the latter part of last year. The parties have now confirmed to Lieutenant General Michael Lolleskaut and to me their agreement to the first phase of the Hodeida redeployment plan.
Despite the official optimism, a spokesman for Yemen's internationally recognized government of President Abdrabu Mansour Hadi told Arab media that his side would not start redeploying until the Houthi militia group evacuated the two smaller ports of Salif and Ras Aissa. He says that the process of the government pullout from its forward positions at kilometer 8 won't start until the first steps of the Stockholm Agreement begin and the Houthi militiamen remove landmines and withdraw their forces from the ports of Ras Aissa and Salif. Saudi-owned Al Arabiya TV reported that the UN has given the Houthis 4 days to withdraw from Ras Aissa and Salif, and that Saudi coalition forces would begin pulling back from parts of Hodeida that they control after the initial Houthi withdrawal. The TV channel indicated that the Houthis would have another 11 days to evacuate the port of Hodeida. Ali Shaabi, a spokesman for the Houthis, told Al Hurra TV that some analysts in the capital, Sana'a, now under Houthi control, were skeptical about implementing the agreement. He says that there remain many obstacles on the ground before implementing the Hodeida agreement and that there are a number of issues still pending that should normally have preceded the pullout, including a ceasefire, which has not completely taken effect, in order to allow the redeployment to begin. Hilal Kashan, who teaches political science at the American University of Beirut, tells VOA that there has been an escalation of the conflict in Yemen in recent days, which does not bode well for a pullback in Hodeida.
The rising military activity does not suggest that the two sides are about to reach terms or that the Houthis are going to pull out. The Houthis are on the offensive on the border with Saudi Arabia. In recent days, they have captured the mountain sites built on the Saudi side of the border. Saudi media reports say at least 16 soldiers were killed last week. This is the largest casualty toll since the beginning of the war.
Kashan argues that the Warsaw Conference on Iran last week has complicated matters in Yemen and that Tehran has been using its clout in Yemen with the Houthis, whom they support, to express their displeasure with the outcome of the international meeting in Poland. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
Among the top stories in the world, the British government's effort to revoke the citizenship of a British-born Islamic State bride now in a refugee camp in northeast Syria risks being overturned on appeal. As China and the U.S. resume high-level trade talks in Washington today, there are signs that the two may be closing in on a deal. European leaders voiced concern over growing anti-Semitism across Europe following a series of attacks on Jewish people and property. And Roger Stone, an advisor to U.S. President Donald Trump, appears in court today for a bail hearing after he posted a picture of the judge in his criminal case on social media with what appeared to be the crosshairs of a target. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the VOAnews.com website and on our VOA mobile app. This is VOA's International Edition.
This is Science in a Minute.
The outermost layer of Earth's atmosphere, called the exosphere, is said to extend to about 10,000 kilometers above the surface. This layer of the atmosphere is mostly hydrogen. Scientists have found that when the hydrogen atoms in the exosphere scatter their protons, they produce a kind of halo effect called the geocorona, which some consider to be an extension of the atmosphere. A new study published in the Journal of Geophysical Research, Space Physics, suggests that with the geocorona, Earth's atmosphere reaches out to about 630,000 kilometers, or twice the distance to the moon. The study authors say they were able to accurately measure the extent of the geocorona by analyzing some 20-year-old data gathered by the NASA ESA Solar and Heliospheric Observatory, or SOHO. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Well, Pope Francis has opened an unprecedented Vatican summit on what he termed the wound of sexual abuse perpetrated by men of the church. Vatican officials call the meeting a powerful and intense experience for all those attending. Sabina Castelfranco has more from Rome.
Prayers and the video testimonies of five unidentified sex abuse survivors from different continents opened the summit. Victims recounted their traumatic experiences. At a Vatican briefing following the opening session, Father Hans Zollner, president of the Center for the Protection of Minors, said the testimonies were brutal, honest, and nothing was spared. Archbishop Charles Scicluna of Malta, top sexual abuse investigator for the Vatican, said the voices they heard were emotional and powerful.
In order to understand the gravity of the situation, you need to listen to victims, meet them, because that is sacred ground.
The Pope summoned bishops from all over the world to come together to discuss what has become the most serious crisis and scandal of the Catholic Church, the sexual abuse perpetrated by members of the clergy. Pope Francis said the Church must listen to the cry of the little ones seeking justice. In his opening statement, Pope Francis told those gathered that the holy people of God are looking to us, expecting not simple and predictable condemnations, but concrete and effective measures to be undertaken. He stressed, "We need to be concrete." Philippines Cardinal Luis Tagle was the first to address the gathering of some 200 participants in the Vatican Synod Hall after the Pope. He choked up as he said that wounds have been inflicted by us, the bishops, on the victims.
Our lack of response to the suffering of victims, even to the point of rejecting them and covering up the scandal to protect perpetrators and the institution, has injured our people, leaving a deep wound in our relationship with those we are sent to serve.
Archbishop Scicluna, the next to address the gathering, said it is our duty to protect our people and to ensure justice when they are abused. He added, "We will protect them at all costs." Scicluna made clear that the church must look carefully at how priests and bishops are chosen. He said the question of screening of future candidates for the priesthood remains of the essence. Ahead of the meeting, sex abuse survivors said they also want to see clergy found guilty of perpetrating or covering up abuse to be removed from their positions. Sabina Castelfranco for VOA News, Rome.
Thank you, Sabina. VOA's International Edition continues. Well, the ongoing unrest in Haiti is impeding the work of medical aid groups in the country. Dr. David Vanderpool is a trauma surgeon and founder of Live Beyond, a medical mission in Haiti. He says the surrounding violence is preventing medical supplies and medicine from getting through ports. In addition, medical teams are not able to enter the country. He spoke with me about the protests and violence in Haiti, which has been going on since last July. He explains why the latest outbreak is different from other protests he has witnessed.
We are about 15 miles east of Port-au-Prince, and so we're not impacted directly at all. Our area is a peaceful area. We work with the extreme poor, and they typically are not involved in political protests. Now, it does impact our ability to go to and from the airport in Port-au-Prince, so that bringing teams in, we bring American teams in twice a month, bringing teams in has been impacted dramatically simply because the airport is in Port-au-Prince and there's so much random violence around it. It can't really be predicted very well. The other thing that impacts us is we ship containers into Haiti through the port there at Port-au-Prince. And since the port has been shut down, these container shipments have been curtailed. And these are food shipments that are in dire need in our area. We have a lot of starvation in our area. And so these are hugely problematic for us and the people that we serve.
At this point, what are some of the medical needs of the people? I know you are a trauma surgeon, so what type of surgery are you doing?
We have had a problem in that we're not able to get our equipment in, and the surgical supplies, the medical supplies, those kinds of things, medicines. And so many of the hospitals in Port-au-Prince have been shut down. We've been operating normally, but we are getting very low on medicines and disposable items as well. So it's problematic in that it's been going on for longer than usual. Generally, when there is violence like this, we've been in country for 7 years, and generally it's sort of short-lived. People are upset about rising gas prices or rising bread prices or something like that, and this is just the way they communicate their despair of the situation. Usually that lasts a couple of days and then it's over. This has been ongoing for quite some time.
What is the ongoing root cause of these particular acts of violence?
It's really hard to say what the root cause is. It is very different. This time is different from past times. And we noticed this starting in July of 2018, that the demonstrations were of a different caliber. These, however, seem to be better organized and better funded. And so one of the things that I've noticed in driving through Port-au-Prince during these demonstrations is that the barriers that are put up are actually welded. They're actually sort of prefabbed barriers such as you would see in the United States. And I've never seen that before in the 7 years that I've been there. And so this sort of suggests that perhaps there's an organized funding that is backing these particular demonstrations. And that may speak to a political end. The things that they've been saying is the Petrocaribe scandal has been going on, and they're calling for protests over that, rising fuel prices that are actually mandated by the International Monetary Fund. But this seems to be more directly political, and it may actually be a change of government.
Do you think the international community should pay more attention now to what is going on in Haiti?
Absolutely. And one of the things that we talk about among ourselves is the United Nations provided security for Haiti for many years under the MINUSTAH acronym. And they pulled out. So that stabilization force, you know, was fraught with problems, but it is entirely necessary. And I think that what we're seeing is that we need a return of this United Nations force to stabilize Haiti. Otherwise, we're just going to see it spiral downward and perhaps even follow a Venezuela-type spiral.
That was Dr. David Vanderpool, a trauma surgeon and founder of Live Beyond, a medical mission in Haiti. This is VOA's International Edition.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Next up, political fallout over U.S. President Donald Trump's declaration of a national emergency. The move, designed to obtain more funding for a border wall without congressional approval, has prompted lawsuits and met with growing public opposition. An update on U.S. politics next on Encounter, Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
The 2019 VOA calendars are in. This year's calendar features a variety of scenic photos that capture U.S. byways, including beautiful photos of the Big Sur Coast Highway and even the historic Route 66. Tune in to Border Crossings at 1500 Universal to request a free calendar.
Well, Samsung has unveiled its newest line of smartphones. The top-selling smartphone maker hopes to inject excitement into a sluggish global smartphone market. VOA's Michelle Quinn attended the event in San Francisco yesterday and gives us a look.
The South Korean electronics company Samsung aims to inject excitement into the sluggish smartphone market. It unveiled a new form for smartphones, its foldable phone, called the Galaxy Fold. Justin Dennison, Samsung Marketing Vice President.
The size of our screens is still fundamentally limited by the size of our devices, until now. With the Galaxy Fold, we're creating a new dimension for your phone and your life.
When closed, the Fold is a smartphone. When open, the Fold turns into an expansive tablet. A user can use three apps at the same time. The Galaxy Fold is slated to go on sale in late April and will cost nearly $2,000. Samsung, the world leader in smartphone sales, also unveiled its new line of Galaxy smartphones, which it launched 10 years ago with the Android operating system. DJ Ko, president and CEO of Samsung's IT and mobile communications division.
No company has done more to put the smartphone at the center of our mobile connected lives.
The S10 comes in three models, S10e, S10, and the S10 Plus. The S10 has bigger screens, more battery life, and more cameras than past Galaxy phones. The firm will also sell an S10 for 5G, the new high-speed network being built now. The S10 has the world's first ultrasonic fingerprint scanner, which uses sound waves that bounce from a user's fingertip to unlock a device. And the phone can act as a charger for other devices. The S10 line will go on sale March 8th. As for the price, Samsung appears to be going after the high end of the market, where Apple dominates, with phones starting at $749. With its foldable phone and new S10 line, Samsung says it is ushering in the next decade's new mobile era. Michelle Quinn, VOA News, San Francisco.
You've been listening to International Edition. You can find us at voanews.com. Thanks for joining us, and thanks to our director, Patrice Martin, and our engineer, Bill Andrade. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.